All right, folks. It's 3:30. We're going to go ahead and get started. Welcome back. We would like to take this time to thank our generous sponsors of the School for Successful Ranching for their support of this program and communities and commitment to producer education. They have small displays set up in the hallway on the floor, and we ask that you visit their booths in the expo and say thank you. We couldn't have done this program without them. Sponsors include Capital Farm Credit, Kettleman's Education Series, Corteva, Houston Livestock Rodeo Show and Rodeo, Lone Star Ag Credit, Positive Feeds, Raybo Agri Finance, Stay Tough Fence Manufacturing, and Texas Beef Quality Assurance. Also, I'd like for you to, if you could, please silence your phones, and if you could remove your hats. Our next speaker is Feed Those Soon to Be Born Calves Right for Long-Term Herd Success, presented by Dr. Kelly Sanders with Westway Feed Products. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Sanders.
Thank you, sir. Well, it's good to be here. It's always good to be at Cattle Raisers, that's for sure. It always seems like to be really educational. This is really, for me, one of the funnest topics to really talk about. And while it talks about soon-to-be-born calves, if you really think about that in the future, we're really kind of talking about what's happening while that calf's in utero, right? So talking about while that baby's in mama. And so this is really a fun one for me. I hope it's educational. And it's to me, it's a thinker, okay? And so I hope I get you to thinking about what we're doing to that bred cow. Really, if you think about it, our paradigm as cattle producers, as a cattle industry, when we think about calves, is really we start thinking about that calf when he's born, and then really when we start weaning that calf, right? We're talking when in the past we've thought about heifer development. We've thought, hey, I got to have this heifer at 65 to 70% of her body weight and all, or her mature body weight to really affect reproduction and things of that nature. But I think it may be important for us to step back a little bit, look at this old cow and say, is it a little more important to think about what's going on with this cow while she's pregnant, the nutrition that we're giving her, and does that affect these heifers later on down the road when they become cows, and does that affect reproduction, lifetime reproduction, and some other things from steer performance and things of that nature. So I want us to think about that. When you think about what's going on, have anybody ever heard about fetal programming? One, two, everybody's starting to fess up a little bit, looks like. Also call it epigenetics, okay? You may see that out there as well, and that's really what I want to talk about. So what in the world is epigenetics? What that is when we have a change in the gene expression, okay, but we don't have a change in DNA. So there's truly not a mutation in our genetic code. It's just that those genes express themselves different than what they really are, okay? And so if we look at that, when I was in Canada hunting, I was moose hunting up there and actually come across this Canadian moose beaver. And that little critter will catch your eye, right? You know, you don't see very many beavers with mouths like that, right? The other thing I was able to dig up on the internet was this African horse monkey, okay? Kind of crazy, right? But one thing about epigenetics is that it doesn't express itself physically like we would see in these pictures. No, ma'am. It's not real. But it was a really good Photoshop, wasn't it? It's extremely good. But it makes my point in the fact that the genes of this beaver never changed, but what he looked like changed, right? And what I'm saying is that's the example, but that's really not what's going on. It's really happening. What changes is things like your health, things like your energy and protein metabolism, all right? The propagation of the species. Those are the things that changes from a genetic standpoint. You say, well, how in the world does that change, right? Well, what's happening is, while your DNA doesn't change, we all remember from science, we have this double helix thing right there. Well, what happens is the structure by which that thing's put together, it's actually changed the formation of it. And when you change the formation of it, it changes the way those genes are expressed themselves. So we really don't get Canadian moose monkeys, but the way he metabolizes his energy might be compromised a little bit. So that's really what's going on. So where'd all this stuff start? Well, really and truly, it's been going on probably forever, right? Because we've had events, nutritional challenges from the time began. Now, the Dutch winter hunger, if you guys can remember a little bit of your history from thinking about World War II, was basically the Dutch were allies with the Americans and the British, right? And so what happened to these guys were in the fall of 44 to the spring of 45, the Germans actually barricaded all the railroads and all the roads going into the Netherlands, and so they were short on food. And so in order to get through that, even though thousands and thousands upon them died, they actually had to ration their food to the point where they were actually consuming about 30% of their daily requirement, okay? So if you think we need 2,000 calories a day, 30% of that, we're getting about 600, right? That's a piece of pecan pie. I know, I hope I didn't ruin that pecan pie deal for you guys during Thanksgiving, but it's about 600 calories. So the good thing about this data set was they had to register in order to get their food. So they had to go down, sign, here's all my family, here where we're at, to get their daily ration. Well, we knew who they were. We knew what women were pregnant, when they were pregnant, when those kids were born. So it was a perfect data set for them to go back and to start looking, because what had happened was when they got to looking at the generation that came out of that particular event, those individuals were having health challenges, okay? So what they found was the women that were pregnant through the first trimester, basically those offspring, their kids that came out of that, had a higher level or a higher propensity to have diabetes, okay? And the other thing was cardiac disease. A lot of the things that we deal with today were coming out of these events. The other thing that was really interesting was the babies that were through that the last trimester, so they were in their mommy's tummy the last trimester, those kids had lighter weights, birth weights. And they also remained smaller their whole lifetime and had a greater propensity to be obese. All right? Funny thing, a follow-up study, I'm going to jump up just ahead just a little bit, a follow-up study on that very similar on obesity was they looked at about, I want to think it was 10,000 nurses across the U.S. because it was a captured population. And so they looked at women that were actually in an obese state but were pregnant. And those babies that came from that actually had a greater propensity to be diabetic and also to be obese as well. So when those actually put those nurses on a diet, okay, and they started losing weight, they got back to a normal weight, and then were pregnant again, they tracked those, guess what? They didn't have that problem. Those children actually had a normal weight gain and didn't have the same propensity to be obese. So there's things going on in the tummy of this mama from a nutritional standpoint, from a stress standpoint, that is changing the way their genetics are. Pretty amazing, right? So these guys had that problem. You can all imagine with the Holocaust, I didn't really want to put too much of that stuff up there just because it's an extremely gruesome thing. But what they did is they tracked the generation that came out of the Holocaust that were born during that, or mamas were pregnant in that, to the next generation. And the generation that went through the Holocaust, those kids that are out of those mamas that were pregnant during that time, had a much greater chance to have health problems than the next generation that didn't go through that in that Jewish population. So another kind of really good thing that showed us that there may be some things going on. The next one that really affected us in the U.S. probably early on was the 1918 flu pandemic that kind of took over the world. It affected 20% of the world and it affected one-third of the U.S., okay? And so if you really look at what was going on there, you had people that were pregnant, and there was a fear factor in that aspect of it, right? But they didn't want to get sick because a lot of people died during that time frame. The other side of it was, even though it wasn't a nutritional event, it was a health event, right? If they did get the flu, it was a health event to those people. And so what came out of that was a little bit different, all right? Basically, there was a 51% increase in the next generation that came out of that for kidney disease, all right? There was a 12% increase in cardiac disease. There was a 20% increase for that generation to be disabled and not to be able to work long term. Some other things there were that the kids that came out of that didn't have the same level of educational attainment as other kids did. And then there was a pretty high incidence of schizophrenia out of that. So, man, it's changing the next generation is getting affected. Now, there's a little bit of information that would also say that once that generation is affected, then potentially it affects the next generation as well. So it just doesn't stop at one. So it makes me think we might need to think about these old cows. Because I know when my wife was pregnant, we took pretty good care of her. We had her own minerals and vitamins, and she didn't miss a meal and all that. Because we know from our perspective, just our innate knowledge that we got to take care of these ladies when they're pregnant, right? But now we're seeing some actual effects out of that. You say, well, that's all well and good. It's interesting from that perspective. How in the world does this really affect me, right? Well, we all sell cattle, don't we? We raise them and we sell them. And so I don't know about you guys, but in our part of the world, I live in the panhandle. And ranches that sell directly to feed yards know exactly what cattle they're buying and how those cattle feed, how they grade, and they track that stuff. Kind of determines what they can get for those cattle, right? Well, the one thing we kind of chased the last several years is quality grade, and we've really been able to increase the quality grade of our cattle. And what we found out by a couple of studies by Martin and Funston out of Nebraska was what they did is they fed cattle a protein-deficient diet versus cattle that weren't. And the steers or the progeny out of those cows actually graded lower in choice grade than their ones that were taken care of at maintenance requirement, okay? So it truly affected the quality grade of the cattle. Didn't mean that all of them didn't grade. It means that there was a reduction in it, okay? Another thing was there was no difference in performance, though. Cattle gained the same amount of weight. They finished at the same endpoint. The only common denominator was they didn't grade well. Now, that's down the road, right? That has some effect on us, but I don't know about you, but we raise cows, calves. We're in the cattle business. This affects me probably more just like it does you. It's a direct effect on us because reproduction of that cow and why I keep those heifers is going to determine maybe what my cow longevity is later on down the road, right? So the question is, it happens to women. Does it happen to cows? Okay, does it happen to those heifers? So there's some information that's pretty fascinating to me on this side in the fact that the same two studies that were done on steers, they took the heifer mates to those, and there was actually a 10 to 13% reduction in pregnancy rates in those heifers compared to the cows that were fed at maintenance or an adequate diet. Okay, so it did actually reduce our pregnancy rates of those heifers that came from those cows that were restricted. Okay, why is that the case? Is that an epigenetic effect? Well, there's a couple of things that some other studies have shown that's really interesting to me. Is one, when a cow is in a pretty severe nutrient restriction, 60 to 70% of what she needs, okay? I mean, she's probably losing weight. She's going from a 5.5 to a 5 down to a 4, okay? It happens. And what happens is there's an elevation of testosterone in that cow. So there's a hormone change in the cow. What that may lead to is that there's a reduction in the actual lifetime follicle supply of the heifer, okay? Because each heifer, just like you women in here, when you're born with a set number of follicles, okay? Follicles turned into babies, right, when they're fertilized. So there's an actual reduction in that lifetime number. Is that because of the testosterone elevation? We don't really know, but it would suggest that. Let's say that, okay? Now, in the heifer itself, there's actually a hormone change that goes on as well. It's kind of strange because you think about it. She's born, and we're now, what, 12, 14 months later, we're going to breed this gal, and there's actually a hormone change in her to breed up. She has a higher level of gonadotropin hormone in that heifer, and there's actually a reduction in progesterone. So what's the big deal about progesterone? Progesterone actually what holds that fetus in place while she's pregnant, okay? So if she doesn't have enough progesterone, guess what? She can't tell herself that she's pregnant. Guess what happens? She sluts the calf, right? She doesn't become pregnant. So one thing that's some interesting information that would kind of make me think back was here lately there came out and said basically, I think it was actually today, on some repro stuff, is that about 98% of AI-bred cows actually conceive. They just don't become pregnant. So, I mean, we're getting the job done, right? We got an egg and we got a sperm and we're putting it together. They just don't become pregnant. They conceive, but they don't become pregnant. So is that due to hormones? I really don't know. You got to think something's going on right there that affects that. But this directly affects me. It directly affects you guys from a long-term cow herd standpoint. So what are some things from a trimester standpoint, because it is it the whole thing or is it just one? Well, in the first trimester, you have this whole potential reduced lifetime supply of oocytes or follicles, right? That's going to be, that happens in the first trimester is the one that's affected the most, all right? Next one is increased follicle stimulating hormone, hormonal change, increased testosterone level happens during that time frame. A reduction in Sertoli cells of the bulls out of that cow can be affected, okay? If we reduce the Sertoli cells in a bull, that actually reduces our sperm count, okay? So bulls aren't as fertile potentially. It could be something that could be affected that. They have enlarged aortas, and they also have an increase in blood pressure, all right? So there's quite a few things that are going on that. Think about this a little bit. During that time frame, what are some of the things that could be affected the most? What develops the most during the first trimester? Your heart, your liver, your lungs, all your major organs, right? So if we have an opportunity to affect something, that's probably where it's going to be, is all those major components, all right? First. Second trimester, some of the things that can be affected is muscle fiber development, okay? One thing about a calf is when he's born with a set number of fiber, okay, or muscle fibers. It's set. Can't increase it, you can't decrease it, right? The other thing is if we actually reduce muscle fiber development during that kind of starts probably the last month of the first trimester, and it goes all the way through the last trimester, okay, the actual muscle fibers. If we reduce that, we have potential to reduce our weaning weights because those cows aren't going to have as much muscle, right? Also, finishing weights. There's been two studies that indicated that there was some reduction in actual carcass weights and final weights of cattle that were out of cows that were nutrient restricted. Kind of leads us to maybe that's something to think about as well. What about third trimester? Because I'll admit, from a nutritional standpoint, we focused on this whole aspect of third trimester, how about we feed the cow. It wasn't so much because of what was going on here. It was really because we knew that's when the fetal growth was the most, right? It's the fastest during the last trimester, and it's also associated with how fast the cow breeds back. So that was the really reason. But here's some other reasons. Muscle fiber development, continuing, okay? Adipocyte development, that happens the last trimester, okay? So what happens during that time frame is if we're nutrient restricted, we don't get enough fat cells developed, right, versus to actually have that calf grade choice, all right? Because what happens in that is if you have more cells, you actually have the opportunity to have more what? Fat cells, intermuscular fat, so she can deposit them there, right? And so if we reduce that number, that may be one of the reasons why we had that reduction in quality grade in those steers, right? Maybe there was that effect right there just from adipocyte development and production. Potential weaning weight can actually be affected there, carcass weights, actually the age of puberty, okay? Heifers that are out of calves, that are cows that are taken care of, actually may come into puberty in estrus just a little bit earlier than other cattle do. Okay? AI conception rates, first 21 days, and health of the calves. I think we can establish health probably. We can pretty much line that over rats, humans, cattle, horses, pigs. That's pretty consistent all the way across them. Right? What about the immunity of calves? This one's a little shadier. There's not a lot of information out there. Number two is we know that cows that aren't taken care of have lower quality colostrum, and we don't have the same amount of colostrum out of those cows. So is that really the underlying factor of immunity in the calves? We don't really know that, but that's something that we have to think about by taking care of cows. So here's some things. We have environmental stress. Can you think of any environmental stress that's going on right now? Anybody seen pictures from Nebraska? Buried cattle in snow, and now they're drowning. That's pretty stressful on an old cow, especially when she's in the last trimester, because they're getting ready to go through spring calving, right? Or they're fixing to be right in the middle of it. You guys, if you're down here where you had all that rain earlier, you guys have had cows wash away, all kinds of flooding down here, right? So pretty big challenge. A lot of environmental stress. Those are things we can't manage. But we do have a lot of tools that we can actually manage around this epigenetic effect. We can't actually fix it, but I think we can manage around it, right? So what is that opportunity? Well, from a nutritionist perspective, one's going to be nutrition, right? So nutrition and health, we can control those things. We can control how much we feed them, what we feed them, what kind of vaccines, when we give those vaccines, deworming programs, all that kind of things. We can control those things, just can't control the weather. One way to do that is through a good nutrition program. A little background on this. This was some field work that I did whenever I was with a different company. And a little history here. It's a ranch in New Mexico. And we had him on a normal 150-day feeding program, right? And he comes to us and says, what if I leave this stuff out year-round? This was a liquid feed program at the time. And my answer to the call was, I think you're crazy, because I don't think there's any way we can manage that feed. They're just going to eat us out of house and home. It'll be way too expensive, right? He said, well, I'm going to do it anyway. All right, so let's track it, right? He had good records. If you look at this is conception rate on this herd. So if you look right here, his average was about 88%. That would have been very, very similar for Texas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico, the average of people that were doing things right. This 94 was he went on the liquid program that year. He put it out for 150 days. That's within some good variation to know, hey, you know what, maybe that's just a blip, change in nutrition, change in grass, things of that nature. When he went to the year-round program, he went from 94 to 98. Awesome. It's a 1,000-cow operation. Doesn't happen very often. I thought, this is great, but, you know, is this an anomaly that's happened? Well, the next year we had 97 and 93 come along, and I thought, son of a gun, came back to haunt me. However, problem with that, the good thing about that when I talked to the guy was he had some 14 and 15-year-old cows that he's never had on the ranch before. And so it really wasn't a bad thing. He just made the longevity of those cows better, right? So the next year was back to 96. That's all well and good. How in the world do you get that, right? Well, if you think about it, for me, when you went to school and went to college, they taught you that cows in good body condition score are cheaper to keep than cows that are in bad body condition score, right? Because you don't have to feed them as much. Well, really and truly, what we allowed these old cows to do was to actually go get the feed they need from that liquid supplement on a year-round basis, free choice, and then graze, right? And we had to manage it. Okay, so they stayed in better body condition score throughout the year. They never took that big drop that went from 5.5 to 4.5 to 3, and then we're feeding her back up, right? And she's in a poor body condition score when she has a calf, and she doesn't lactate as good, right? We didn't have to go through that. Cows stayed in better body condition score, so they bred up a little bit better. The other side of this was we looked at weaning weights, okay? Their average here on their steers was somewhere around 525 pounds. Heifers were right at 500 on the average. That would be very consistent with about 20 years of data they had. When they went to a year-round program, they jumped on steers from 619, 603, 616, about 90-pound difference. Heifers were about 50 to 60 pounds different, and that was consistent throughout all those years. How in the world do you do that? You think the more cows actually increase their lactation a whole lot better? A little bit. There's no way you can put a cow can lactate enough to put 90 pounds on a calf. It wasn't that they lactated so much better. It was the fact that those cows were breeding back 30 days earlier, right? It's easy to put 60 pounds on a calf when you breed back 30 days earlier, right? 30 days plus 2 pounds equals 60 pounds. That's really what happened. We were just pulling cows up. They were breeding back earlier just because they were in better body condition score. So we were actually mitigating a lot of those problems from a nutritional stress that we didn't actually have in the past, right? Not saying that was always going on, because I don't think epigenetic is something that goes on every single day, all right, every single year. I think we do a much better job feeding cattle than we did 20 years ago, okay? But we were able to mitigate some of those potential problems there and actually made the ranch a lot profitable. So here's the big deal. That's all great, but what did it cost us, right? That's the end of the day, because when we get to round 10, we want more calves, we want heavier calves, but it costs more money. Well, really and truly, right out there, the average is about 3.75 pounds. If we put it on feeding cubes per head per day to meet those cows, that's about 528 pounds, I believe. I think I've got it on another slide. But what happens was they average 1.9 for that day, for that year, 1.35, 1.8. That was a great year. So the cows adjusted their intake based on the quality of the grass that the ranch had. Next year, they went back to 1.2, all right? So if you really think about that, cows actually ate less, 22% less feed on a year-round basis versus hand-feeding them. It gives us more comfort to hand-feed, right? Because we want to control that piece of the puzzle. I worked with a lot of ranchers that I want to control that piece of the puzzle so I can manage my cost. I understand that. I like to do it too. I like to determine how many cubes or what tub I put out, things of that nature. But really and truly, we have an advantage when we allow that cow to adjust her diet to the grass, the environment, and things of that nature. And the dividends are in heavier weaning weights due to breed ups are better, things of that nature. More calves, more weight. Okay, we also are mitigating these epigenetic effects by allowing that cow to do it to some degree. Like, remember, we can't manage all of that. So how do we do that just through feed? We have to manage our body condition score. We have a good system out there. If we track body condition score, that tells us where those cows are nutritionally, right? We need those cows in a 5 or better, as it should be our goal year-round, all right? A program that allows a cow to select that based on the grass and the quality of grass she has allows her to do that a little bit better than I do, because when I try to pick it, or when I try to determine she does a better job, I can't do a better job than she has. What I'm trying to say is, when I choose it, I'm always behind the curve, right? By the time I see her lose body condition, it's time to feed. Guess what? I'm behind the curve. She's in kind of a hunger state, right? That's why cows tend to eat more on a free choice system when you just feed them for 150 days versus year round, strictly because they're in a hunger state already, so they eat more, right? So that's one way to mitigate those effects. Working with your local vet, making sure your health program's up to speed, vaccinations are right. Okay, all those things are a way to mitigate those things. All right? So there's ways to mitigate it. We have tools to do it. So here's my disclaimer. Okay, you guys are willing, and I'm willing to answer any question you got, but if I don't know the answer, it's because I've had some epigenetic event. So that's what I've got today. Hopefully that was educational, something to think about. Okay, I'm not saying, like I told you, it's not happening every year or anything like that. We do a much better job than we've done the last 20 years of managing cattle and nutrition in cattle. But this is something to think about when you think about herd longevity, calf longevity, heifer longevity in your herd. Okay, questions? Yes, sir. Yeah, it's a good idea. So if you think about it, I like to put it on a stool basis, okay? Three-legged stool. You got protein, you've got energy, and you got minerals and vitamins, okay, from a nutritional standpoint. So we've got to meet the protein requirement, because protein in that cow. She has a protein requirement, but we actually feed the bugs. We really don't feed the cow. Those bugs actually feed the cow, because those bacteria that digest all that feed, they're going to supply anywhere from 60 to 70% of the protein requirement to the cow. All right? And so we've got to do that good job, a job supplying those bugs the right amount of protein. Then after that, we got to meet her energy requirement. And because it's a stool, both of them are the same importance. We think about protein all the time because that's what we've been taught. It's all we studied, whole nine yards forever. But energy is why that fat comes off that cow's back, right? We feed a fat steer corn energy to make him fat. Cow has to have energy to be fat. She has to have energy to lactate, all those kind of, to breed back. That's the determining factor when she breeds back, is when her body's in good enough body condition score from the level of nutrition, of energy and protein in her diet, that it says, okay, I'm in good enough flesh right now to breed back. It's one of those things that's important. Mineral and vitamins are extremely important as well, right? Vitamins are going to and are really high on the level of antioxidants and things of that nature. They're part of enzyme cascades. Mineral on the other side is a whole host of cascades. It runs a lot of the system. Even runs the copper and zinc are extremely important in the immune system itself. So trying to balance that out so you provide enough protein, energy, mineral, and vitamins to those cows, you should be on a good nutrition program. So your next question may be, so what is that? Well, a cow that's lactate needs about 2 pounds of protein. She needs about anywhere from 12 and a half to 14 pounds of TDN, okay? And so TDN is going to be considered energy. And then if you have a good free choice mineral out year-round, you should have that taken care of as well. So it's not something difficult. We just have to be extremely diligent about it. We use our tools like body condition score, things of that nature. If you want to use a free choice liquid, a free choice tub, something like that, that's an option as well, that you keep that in front of cattle all the time. And then manage where you put it, right? If you get your extension agent, a nutritionist from a feed company, something like that, they can all help design those things to meet a good nutrition program, minerals, vitamins, protein, and energy. Does that answer it or no? Close enough. We can talk afterwards if you'd like to, if you have more specific questions. Yes, ma'am? Yes, ma'am. Liquid is like a liquid molasses program. So you're using molasses, some NPN, some other protein sources. You're putting that in front of cows. They're able to go up on a lick wheel and lick that. Free choice. Lick tub could, no, that's not a lick tub. That actual data was done on a liquid, like a molasses liquid program. They lick it off of a wheel. So it's in a big round tub. Okay, they put this liquid molasses in it. It's got some wheels on it. And the cows go up there and lick that wheel. And they just turn it around, and that's where they get their energy from. So molasses has a lot of sugar in it, okay? And so sugar is an energy source. And so that provides some energy to the cattle, some NPNs in that product to provide protein. We do. Yeah, there's several different companies out there that are in the liquid business. We just happen to be one of them.
There's one in the silent auction too.
There is a big red one in there. Yeah, we could. That's right.
So how does the liquid compared to the tubs?
Okay. Well, because of packaging and manufacturing costs, tubs are always going to be more expensive, right? They add some convenience because you don't have to buy equipment, all right? So if you have a dealer that has liquid, they may rent you a tub or a big lick wheel. You can rent that. You can buy those from that standpoint. If you're a large operation, you might want to put in that equipment yourself. It all costs quite a bit of money to do it, all right? But it's significantly cheaper from a product standpoint. So over time, there is some cost savings to it. Product performance, if you have a really good liquid product, the opportunity you have with that over, say, a general group of tubs from different companies is that it's easier to put a higher level of fat in that. Fat, it has some benefits from reproduction, especially it also adds some more energy to the diet for those cows to get your energy up. And so it has some, I would say, benefits there that you might not be able to get with a lot of tubs, all right? Tubs are just more convenient, and then it all goes back to how much they eat, right? So if you have a cook tub, which we make cook tubs, that's limited to about a half a pound to a pound. Works really good in the summer and in the fall. During the dead of winter, when at least in my part of the world, New Mexico and the Panhandle, it really doesn't meet protein and energy requirements, and we need something that's a 2 to 3 pound intake on that. So it just depends on where you're at and what type of hay you have or grass that you're dealing with is how you want to establish on a tub program, okay? Anything else? Okay, it's a good question. It costs about $75 a cow to feed that year round. If you figure 1.25 pound per head per day, about $75. If you feed somewhere around 3 to 4 pounds, it costs about $70 to $80, depending on how quality a cube you get. That's before transportation, the whole nine yards, right? So the last calculation I had on that was about $50 per cow exposed advantage for the year-round program versus hand feeding, all cost in. That's per cow exposed, not per cow that had a calf.
There were no supplements in that other than the liquid feed and minerals.
That would be correct, yes, sir, on that particular ranch. Yes, sir. All right. I appreciate you guys. Thank you.
Thank you all, folks. Y'all have a good evening, and we'll see y'all tomorrow.